This project is about easy cases and legally guilty defendants. More narrowly, this is a project about charging discretion in petty public order cases, and I'll define what that is pretty shortly.
You did it in one place a little bit.
I think this is an important focus because you have to understand that our criminal justice system is comprised primarily of petty cases, and in the past two decades, this has come to be more and more the case. The pool of public order cases and petty cases have grown dramatically with the ascendancy of order maintenance policing and broken windows theory more generally, and that's particularly true in certain urban areas like New York City. In petty public order cases, the question of legal or factual guilt is often secondary. What these cases turn on instead are normative assessments of relative blameworthiness. What I would say is that in this way, easy legal cases may raise tough normative questions. All of this, I think, highlights an underappreciated fact about discretion more generally, which is that there are actually three sets of reasons for discretion's exercise, not just legal and administrative reasons, but equitable reasons as well. So a prosecutor may decide not to charge because she feels that she lacks sufficient proof of legal guilt. She may decide not to charge because she wishes to preserve limited resources, or she might decide not to charge because she concludes that the prospective defendant is in fact insufficiently blameworthy or that the conduct is otherwise insufficiently serious. So this last strand, this equitable strand, what this says is that even a legally guilty defendant may not be charged in certain instances, notwithstanding solid proof of legal guilt, because he is normatively innocent, or what I would call normatively innocent. Now, to give a few examples, which I also give in the paper, these are examples from my own experience. At a client who's a 16-year-old runaway who was arrested for prostitution. Several times I would have poor clients who were arrested for hopping turnstiles in order to get to work, and payday wasn't until Friday. No joke, I had an elderly client who was arrested for selling frozen ices on, anyone who's been in New York has seen the icy guys in the street, selling ices on one of the hottest days of the year without a vending license. Now, it's up for debate, maybe not with the last example, but it's up for debate with the other examples, whether prosecutors should charge any of these defendants. My claim is not that they are definitively not blameworthy or that they should face no charges at all, only that blameworthiness is an open question in these cases. And in fact, I'd submit that oftentimes it's the only open question. Okay, so now I've sort of segregated out these three strands of discretion. I want to further point out that there's general consensus in both case law and commentary, that all three sets of reasons, the equitable, the administrative, and the legal, are valid reasons for the exercise of charging discretion. Indeed, in the petty crime context, in the mala prohibita context more generally, some exercise of measured equitable discretion is particularly warranted. Now, why is that so? Well, legislatures have a tendency to pass overlapping and expansive criminal codes. They do so in order to provide something of a menu to the executive, an enforcement menu. But the legislature and the public more generally concurrently anticipate that the prosecutor, the executive, is going to do something with this menu. They're going to tailor it equitably as opposed to enforcing it or trying to enforce it absolutely. So significantly, even though I guess a further point I'd make is that so we've got some consensus that categorical enforcement is impossible and probably unwise, but reasonable minds disagree about when equitable discretion should be exercised in any given case. What's the right case to cut out? What's the right legally guilty defendant not to charge? By the way, this is not just a contemporary insight about legislative overcriminalization. It's really an Aristotelian insight that legal rules necessarily can be made only so narrow. equitable discretion fills the gap by accommodating broad legal rules to the particulars of individual cases. In this way, equitable discretion, properly bounded by law, is not counter to, but instead may serve to perfect the rule of law. At least it's the Aristotelian approach, and an approach that I endorse in this piece. And that's what that's the first half of my article. The first half of my article is a defense of the exercise of equitable discretion as necessary and proper, at least in a criminal justice system defined by substantive overcriminalization. My main contribution, I think, is in the second half of the piece, where I challenge a bit of conventional wisdom. Specifically, there's a conventional wisdom that the prosecutor is best situated to exercise charging discretion. And the argument goes like this. Okay, first, it makes sense to leave legal reasons for charging or not principally to the prosecutor, because she knows the most about the evidentiary merits or the support for a given charge. Second, it makes the most sense to leave administrative reasons wholly to the discretion of to the province of a prosecutor, because she knows the most about her strategic priorities and her limitations. Now, I don't challenge that. That assumption of prosecutorial competency as to those two strands holds. It's correct, but only as far as it goes. The problem is that it doesn't go far enough. Left unaddressed is the harder, further question of whether prosecutors are also better situated to reach common sense determinations of whether defendants ought to be charged. Instead, prosecutors are granted the same amount of discretion, really more deference, and this deference is granted almost as an afterthought, unsubjected to much considered scrutiny of any kind. But I simply do not see why prosecutors have some special claim over normative questions of blameworthiness. It's not obvious to me what it is about prosecutorial. It's not that they're particularly, they are human, so they're able to engage in this common sense reasoning that all of us engage in, but it doesn't seem to be anything about the training or skill of a prosecutor that makes them especially well suited to exercise common sense normative judgment. The impetus for this piece sort of arose out of a similar feeling I had when writing my last piece. My last piece was about drug courts. And I had this discomfort with the fact that drug courts asked institutional actors to fill odd roles, to wear sort of ill-fitting hats. So, for instance, a drug court judge is asked not just to be a judge, but he's also asked to be something of a therapist. A defense attorney in drug court, when advising a client whether to take drug court or not, is asked not just to be a defense attorney, but to be a diagnostician of therapeutic success. And likewise here, a prosecutor is asked not just to be a prosecutor, but to be something of a moral arbiter. I will admit there are certain arguments about why a prosecutor might have superior competency when it comes to normative considerations. The best argument that I can come up with is experience. Experience is repeat players. Prosecutors are imbued with what Carl Llewellyn might have called a situation sense, an eye for atypical cases. But my position is that experience has certain unconsidered, at least underconsidered, drawbacks and trade-offs. I'd put it this way. The dark side of experience is indifference. You know, what do I mean by that? If you guys were to walk into an inferior criminal court, a lower criminal court, for the first time, the first thing you'd notice would be the wretched conditions, the frenetic pace of it all, kind of the filth, the human drama of the whole thing. By contrast, when a seasoned litigator, whether it be a defense attorney or a prosecutor, walks in there, they see their day's work. Even the Supreme Court has recognized this sort of dulling of the senses over time. The Supreme Court noted that, this is from Argersinger, for most defendants in the criminal process, there is scant regard for them as individuals. They are numbers on dockets, faceless ones to be processed and sent on their way. In this way, law practice in inferior criminal courts is not so different than medical practice in emergency rooms. The first priority is to take care of cases. So lawyers and doctors, they're not hard-hearted. They're not callous because they're callous people. Rather, it's something of a coping mechanism. They have to detach from the persistent misery around them to engage effectively with the kind of day's work, the technical puzzles. Judge Posner made this point about judges, but it's equally true about defense attorneys and prosecutors. Just as doctors tend to be callous about sick people, judges tend to be callous about pathetic litigants because they have seen so many of them. So the professional prosecutor, based on his or her experience, may get an eye for the equitably atypical case, but there's a certain hesitancy on that experienced person's part to gaze through this eye. So experience is one value, but freshness is another, and the seasoned litigator simply doesn't have that. Now, this tendency of institutional actors, institutional lawyers more specifically, to lump things into boxes, categories, and types, I don't think it's just a product of on-the-ground experience or maybe, you know, world weariness. I think it's also a product of what you guys are going through right now, which is legal training and the development of a legal mind, a legal thinking. In cliched terms, lawyers are asked to think inside the proverbial legal box. And this is a type of thinking that is very critical when it comes to evaluating the legal merits or lack thereof of a given charge, but it may be antithetical to considering adequately equitable merits. Michigan Supreme Court identified this over a century ago when they said professional persons are under a constant temptation to make the law symmetrical by disregarding the small things. But when it comes to equitable considerations, the small things simply can't be disregarded. These small things are vital to particularization, particularized assessments of blameworthiness. Okay. So that's the potential problem with prosecutors based on their skill and their mindset and their experience. Beyond that, there are certain institutional factors unique to the enforcement and adjudication of petty public order cases that render professional prosecutors unable to sufficiently account for equitable considerations, at least at the point of charge. So, here in my paper, I tell something of an institutional story. And I'm careful to call it a story because to some degree it is conjecture, but I think it's plausible conjecture, and I think it's something we need to have a conversation about. And this story starts with the police. Specifically, when police enforce petty crime, specifically public order crime, in urban areas, high crime areas, they tend to move towards engaging in a great number of arrests, a high rate of arrest. And they're incentivized to make arrests first because by arresting defendants, they're able to search defendants and therefore possibly find evidence of more serious crimes. They're also able to process defendants, and in the process of processing defendants, they're able to collect and catalog pedigree information. So, you know, fingerprints, mugshots, sometimes even DNA samples, and that can help police to fight more serious crime. Third, there's an impact that comes from professionalization. Police who must abide by modern procedural rules have to deal professionally with petty problems that in the past they might have just dealt with a measure of rough justice. And how do you deal with something professionally? Well, you make a formal arrest. Thus, is this somewhat well documented phenomenon whereby broken windows policing or order maintenance policing more generally has a way of morphing into something that comes close to approximating zero tolerance for petty crimes. Not necessarily because police normatively desire to see legal cases made out of all these arrests, but simply because the arrests themselves carry with them or help the police meet institutional objectives. Okay, so then you got this big pool of recent arrestees, and the job falls to the prosecutor to separate the wheat from the chaff, to pick up the discretionary slack and determine equitably which charges to go forward with. And prosecutors have significant authority to engage in such discretion. That was my point at the beginning, but they tend to be overcautious for institutional reasons. Now, why is that so? Well, first we have to look at how most of these cases develop. I just told you the policing story. Most of these cases are the product of direct police observation. They're police-initiated cases. Prosecutors see police officers as teammates, and prosecutors know that police put a high premium on solidarity. So to facilitate good relations with the police force, prosecutors are incentivized to charge reflexively, not to reject police output. In this way, prosecutorial charge decisions are somewhat path-dependent on police arrest decisions. Second, even if prosecutors were more willing to reject police output, even if there weren't this concern about fealty toward the police, it'd be hard for prosecutors to separate the wheat from the chaff at the point of charge, because they are operating under certain informational constraints. They know little about the case at the point of charge beside what police tell them. And police don't tell them much, because when police make these arrests, they fill out skeletal paperwork with very little meaningful content beyond perp was seen committing some prescribed act. So there's no consistent or clear signal that's going to separate the equitably or legally weak or case from the strong case. Instead, the prosecutor just goes forward with all of them or something close to all of them, and then decides that that doesn't mean that they go forward with all of them and the equities never come in. Rather, there's a lot of room for the equities to come in at the point of bargain. So they come in as sort of afterthoughts once the case has been charged. They're a way in which lawyers can, or defense attorneys, try to differentiate their client from the mine run of clients, this case from the mine run of cases. The bargaining process is kind of the last best tool to persuade a prosecutor to deviate from the conventional going rate plea. So this whole story, the takeaway from it, I would say, is that prosecutors risk little and gain much in the form of cheap and expeditious plea convictions by filing perfunctory charges followed perhaps soon thereafter by lenient and speedy bargains. So the equities may come in, but they only come in to influence plea deals. And this is not, you know, it's not a case of all's well that ends well, because these equitable plea deals may be insufficient remedy for the normatively innocent defendant who should have never been charged in the first instance. Why? Because plea deals, even lenient plea deals, carry nominal convictions. And even nominal convictions carry with them very serious collateral consequences. They impact defendants' education, employment, immigration, and housing prospects. And I would submit that these collateral consequences may thereby serve to function as gateways into the commission of more serious crime by limiting opportunities. So we end up with too large a pool of ultimately charged and convicted petty crime defendants. And this too large pool is too large for two reasons. It may run counter to equitably perfected justice, and it also might run counter to optimal crime control. Now, I'm going to finish up with this and then go on to my approach to the piece. I said this was somewhat speculative, but notably, the data out there seem to bear out my claims. It's incredibly hard, notoriously difficult, to find data on misdemeanor case processing. But with the great help of our library here, they managed to find me data from New York and Iowa. Now, if my intuitions about police arrest decisions and prosecutorial charge decisions are correct, I would expect to see two trends. We would expect more frequently for prosecutors to charge police initiated cases based on police observation, because those are the cases where prosecutors want to feel the most compulsion to show solidarity with the police, We would also expect to see a higher rate of charge in pettier cases, because these are the cases where prosecutors can readily anticipate quick and dirty pleas with minimal outlay of resources. And that's what the data show. So in New York, the quintessential public order offense, turnstile hopping, we see that case declined half as often as homicide. In short, prosecutors declined to prosecute homicide twice as frequently as turnstile hops. They declined to prosecute larceny three times as frequently as turnstile hops, robbery four times as frequently as turnstile hops, and assault almost six times as frequently as turnstile hops. The Iowa data show that prosecutors are more likely to decline, 14 times more likely to decline felony charges than simple misdemeanors. They're three times more likely to charge or to decline violent felonies than public order felonies, and they're two and a half times more likely to decline violent misdemeanors than public order misdemeanors. So the most commonly charged offenses are these most peripheral offenses, these petty public order offenses. I don't want to overstate these data, nor do I want to overstate the claim that prosecutors are, say, definitively worse than some other body at equitable screening. This is just the first part of really a four-part series on the theme of equitable discretion in the charging decision. And my aim in both this article and the next one, my aims are modest. I merely want to raise doubts about this really unquestioned allocation of equitable power in our criminal justice system, and thereby start something of a conversation. And that's a conversation I take up in the next article, where I talk about how we might admit some lay intuition into the charging decision without unduly sacrificing efficiency, equality, or other rule of law values. I mean, my bottom line is that professionals are not so uniquely competent at normative judgment, and laypersons are not so decidedly inept. So that's this piece, and I guess I'll spend 10 minutes or so, 5 or 10 minutes right now, talking about how I decided on this topic, how I went about writing it, what my methodological approach is. So this started even before I got here, a couple months before I got here, where I had something of an insight about grand juries. And I was thinking that, you know, what grand juries really do is they provide an equitable screen. The ostensible function of a grand jury is to measure the legal merits, to say, is there probable cause? And I'm going to check the prosecutor's judgment that there is probable cause, and there is sufficient evidence to demonstrate probable cause as to each and every element of each and every charge. So I thought, no, that's not really what grand juries do. What grand juries do is they check the prosecutor when the prosecutor ought not go forward. The next thing I did with this idea is, and this is what I would strongly recommend with any of you guys who are thinking about a project, is I shared it. This is a lesson that I didn't learn until I did a fellowship at Chicago, that writing an academic piece is not a hermetic process. And it was something of dumb luck that I ended up in the perfect situation in a fellowship at Chicago, because I thought, okay, what do I need in order to succeed in making the transition from practice to academia? I need a Westlaw password that's paid for, I need a salary so that, you know, my family doesn't go hungry, and I need an office. And what I quickly found is that if I had just gotten those things, I wouldn't be where I am, and I wouldn't be producing scholarship that I hope is good, but whatever it was, it would be much, much worse. Because you really have to immerse yourself in the culture, and that means exposing other people to your writing, getting their feedback, being exposed to their writing and their ideas, attending workshops like you guys are doing now, attending presentations, because one of the hardest things to figure out, and I certainly haven't mastered it, is how to identify a good question from a bad question. And quite frankly, what makes a good question for the purposes of a student note is not necessarily that which makes a good question for the purposes of a full article. So, okay, how did I share my idea? Well, right after I got here, besides sharing it informally, I did what's called an incubator lunch, where we sit around and you just talk informally about some quarter-baked notion that you have, and you get lots of feedback. And when I did that, I realized pretty quickly that I had a problem, and I was going to have end up with a piece that didn't really do what I wanted it to do if I just started talking about the grand jury. I first had to explain why it mattered. I had to make the case for why we wanted something short of absolute enforcement of our criminal laws, and particularly our more petty criminal laws. And then I had to make the case why, that being the case, we would want a lay body to engage in this equitable screening as opposed to a professional body. I had some intuitions why that was so, but my own internal intuitions, I can't expect those to be shared by the rest of the world. I have to make the claim. So I put the grand jury piece on the back burner, and on the front burner, I put what you have in front of you and the next piece. The problems with professional discretion, or the potential problems with professional discretion, and the advantages of lay discretion. And so in the process, I ended up with something great, which is potentially 3 to 4 articles out of one initial discrete idea, sort of keeping in line with what one of my mentors once told me as I was making the transition from practice to academia, which is never write one article when you can write three, which is something to do. But here there really is three. There's got to be three there, but there is three here, I think. So you're looking at what about 1.5 years through a multi-stage process that I expect to take about 3 years. Very briefly, I'm going to tell you how I go about creating a draft, how I go about writing. First thing I do, obviously, is read. And when I read, the only way I know how to read hard is to read on hard copy. It's unfortunate for the environment, but it's the way I get it done. And so I read and read and read, and I write a bunch of margin notes, and I put all sorts of inscrutable little jottings all over my writing and my reading, and then I create a big stack of documents, and then I spend a long time, an almost interminably long time, taking that big stack of documents and distilling from it notes, cites, and quotes, and throwing them into a sort of electronic basket, what I would call a master document, which ends up being like 150 to 200, 250 pages long, and it's just a mess. And then I spend a long time sorting these notes and ideas and quotes. And in this way, I'm taking a big mold, mass of clay, and I'm starting to shape it. And then when I actually start writing, I've got everything where I want it to be. I've got all my source material where I want it to be, and the writing at that point comes very fast. And I like doing it that way. And that way, I would call it taking clay and shaping it down into a sculpture. Hopefully it's a good sculpture, as opposed to the other way of doing it would be to sort of build from the ground up. Start writing and then sort of collect your source material later. Or you've read the source material, but you go back looking for exactly where it is after you've actually written the prose. The prose comes last for me. It's not to say that that's the right way to do it. I think it's important for you guys to hear about as many ways as possible, because the right way for you to write is the way that works. You know, and you may have to experiment to figure that out. What I do want to specify, and I think that there's only one way to do this, is that you don't want to let your ideas calcify. You don't want to settle on a project. You always want to keep an open mind about letting your thesis evolve and change. And it may be hard. You may say, oh, you know, but this is what I thought my article was going to be, and now I realize it's not going to be that. But you'll often, more often than not, find that what it evolves into is something a lot better than what you had in the first instance. So, you know, think about that initial idea as just like grabbing a thread. You've got some purchase, but you got to follow that thread and see where it leads, and not be content to just hone in on that idea and never move from it. What would my methodological approach be? And that's something I'm I'm still working on. I'd say it's something of a mixed bag. My bent is principally pragmatic, analytic. I'd say neorealist. Most of my ideas have come from my practical experience. It's certain intuitions about the institutional incentive structure, and then I look to the source material and, to a lesser degree, the empirical data to see whether my intuitions bear out. I say to a lesser degree the empirical data simply because, and this is the last thing I want to highlight, I don't have the skill set to engage in a rigorous empirical project. And I think that's an important lesson too, which I'll end on, which is, don't take on more than you can do. Don't try to do something you are not equipped to do. Aim at the beginning to just, this cliche, but it's true, hit a single. Sometimes, and don't write an empirical piece if you don't have the empirical skills. Don't write a philosophy piece if you don't have the philosophical chops. Every now and then you'll see an early article or a student note that's entitled something like "Reconceiving Due Process for the 21st Century," and I'm just thinking that would take a career to come up with a coherent reconception of due process for the 21st century, and only if you're a genius to begin with. So go for the modest project. And I've talked for long enough, so I'd like to open it up to you guys.